Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello. Welcome to New Books and Music, a channel on the New Books Network. My name is Bradley Morgan, and I am joined today by my guest, Micaiah Henley. Micaiah is an adjunct professor at Bluegrass Community and Technical College in Lexington, Kentucky, and is also the creator of the music podcast You Forgot One, which is in its fourth and final season. His latest book is The Clash's Santanista, a recent installment in the 33 and a third music book series published by Bloomsbury Academic. Micaiah, thanks so much for joining me today.
Yeah, happy to be here.
So to get things started, could you share with us what your book is about?
Sure. Well, it's about the album Santanista by The Clash, which is a triple LP that comes off of the success of London Calling. And it's an album that is very divisive, even among Clash fans, who, by the way, are very devout people. The band slogan is the only band that matters. And people really took that to heart, you know. But this album defines even the most devout fans, because some people say, well, this should have been a double LP, should have been a single LP. There's all like garbage on here. There's like some good songs. And some critics called it, you know, the punk rock white album. And some critics said that it was trash or it should have just been shorter. And, you know, a lot of people had a lot of things to say, a lot of good things, a lot of bad things. Even the people who praised it would call it things like a flawed masterpiece. And as someone who's like, I think it's just a masterpiece. I think it's just a great album, you know? So for me, I wanted to talk about that. And I love this series because you can talk about albums differently than you would in other books. So I wanted to kind of approach it from a music listener perspective, who also has, you know, the background that I have. And it really kind of entertained that parlor question. Well, what if it is one album? One LP, rather, you know, what do we gain and what do we lose? And ultimately, I think we lose more than we gain if this were released as just a 12-track LP. And what a lot of people don't know is that there actually is a precedent for that 12-track LP. There was a promotional LP called Santanista Now. It was just 12 tracks that was released to like DJs and promoters to kind of have a condensed version with like instructions on kind of how to sell the record and promote the record and which tracks to play. So we use that as the precedent. It's like, okay, so we have a 12-track Santanista. Is it better? Or in what ways is it better? You know, and I have to admit, you know, I approach this as an apologist to the 36-track triple LP. You know, so going into it, I'm like, this thing doesn't need to be cut down. But, you know, it's worth entertaining. And since so many people already do it, I figured that it should be documented in this book series.
So The Clash were released Santanista toward the end of 1980. But before we dive into the album, I want to go back a few years. Could you tell us more about The Clash's place in the growing punk scene and how they became to be referred to as you mentioned earlier, the only band that matters?
Sure. I mean, they are there with the Sex Pistols and other groups like The Slits, who are opening for them, you know, this groundbreaking, literally world-changing moment. And the explosion is really 1977. You can even listen to an older single there. It's called 1977. That was the B-side to the original version of White Riot. And the Clash were, in some ways, kind of the opposite side of the coin to the Sex Pistols, who were much more nihilistic. You know, they would say things like, there's no future. And the Clash, who were big reggae fans, just had a different perspective. That they were actually as angry as they were, you know, and late 70s England was tough living conditions. They were squatters. You know, Joe was a squatter, living in just empty houses. Unemployment for young people was a major issue. There were strikes. You know, they were tough living conditions. There was a lot to be angry about. And yet there was an optimism there. And I think a lot of that comes from things like reggae, where so much of the music is about the destruction of Babylon. You know, so there's an optimism there that another world is possible. So it's not that there's no future. There is a future, and we can actually make it a place that we want to live in. And that's kind of what has always separated the Clash from other punk groups, especially the Sex Pistols in particular.
So the album was met with mixed reviews when it was released, and that was due to it being so big and with a lot of songs, and as you said earlier, called a flawed masterpiece. And it came on the cusp of London Calling, which was the double LP. You write in your book that these two albums risked contradicting the Clash's early punk ethos. Could you tell us more about that ethos and how this direction was contradicting that?
Right. So much of early punk was reacting to, you know, what was already at the time considered classic rock. You know, I referenced the single 1977, where they sing, you know, no Elvis, no Beatles, or the Rolling Stones in 1977. And of course, Elvis dies in 1977, and the Beatles are long broken up, and now the Rolling Stones are, by 1978, going to release like a disco single with Beast of Burden, you know, and to them, you know, they had lost the essence of rock and roll, you know, so these songs were raw, and they were aggressive, and, you know, abrasive, and they were about something, you know, so there was something about the spirit of early rock and roll that they tapped onto. But also the like contemporary political problems, that they were combining those things. And also there's an amateurism. Paul Simonon didn't know how to play bass when he joined the Clash. You know, so, and I think good punk rock requires some sort of amateurism. You know, even when you listen to early rock recordings, they don't really know how to record it. You know, they're experimenting with a reverb. They're trying to figure out how to, you know, places in the South weren't even allowed to have drums in recordings. So, like, how do you make this sound good? You know, so I just think that good rock music, and especially good punk music, requires some sort of amateurism. And so when you're, but as an artist, of course, you want to grow. You can't do that forever. You know, there was even a time where they wanted to release the demos for London Calling as the album, as the third album. But they released London Calling, which is a very slick record. You know, it's punk rock, but it's masterfully performed and recorded, even though famously there are times where the tempo changes and they speed up and they flub a note here or there. But of course, that's what makes it rock and roll. But it's pretty polished, and it's a double LP. You know, it's basically like them making, if you're a gatekeeping punk of the late 70s, it's like them making Exile on Main Street, you know, because they're, so now they're doing like New Orleans rhythm and blues, but there's like a ska song, and then there's a reggae song. So it's like Exile on Main Street, but with kind of different roots, not just in the American South, but elsewhere, tackling all these different genres. Some of them are long songs. You know, punk was supposed to be short. You know, these singles, these songs should be able to fit on a 45, like 2.5 minutes, get your message out there, get in, get out. Kind of that Tom Petty, Don't Bore Us, Get to the Chorus kind of thing. And so with these kind of long songs, these massive albums seem to be so, you know, contrary to kind of the early tenets of punk rock.
Yeah, it's really funny how those albums get accused of, you know, part of the pun here, clashing with that early punk ethos, but there's so much inherent within the album itself. I know you said there's too many songs, but there was an interesting quote in your book that you say that great albums are more than just a collection of great songs, and that Sandinista is best appreciated when you consider how the Clash fought to keep the fought their label to keep the album price down. And that inherently is a very punk thing, and I think that's one of like the great things about this album is that, okay, you get all these songs, but it cost you just the price of one vinyl. Could you tell us more how about that came about?
Yeah, absolutely. So the Clash were very combative against the label. They didn't really understand what they were doing when they signed to CBS. And actually, a lot of these gatekeeping punks, who I referred to earlier, a lot of them say that punk rock died in 1977. That was a big explosion, and it left just as soon as it came, you know, because once they signed to a major label, it was done. You know, that's how a lot of people felt. But they didn't understand what they were doing. And so they thought that if they did like a double LP and a triple LP, they say, well, look, we turned in this many albums, so you can let us go from our contract. And they're like, well, that's not really how it works. Just because this is a double LP or a triple LP, that's two albums, not five. You still owe us, you know? So there was a kind of a misunderstanding on their part how to do it. And they really kind of bucked against that. You know, it's a very interesting thing to test your label by, one, calling it Sandinista, which is a very controversial thing to say at the time in England. You know, they're saying that Thatcher was trying to ban any use of the word in media. And so for them to name it the title of their third album, that's a tough sell. And especially in the, you know, Reagan has been elected but not inaugurated by the time the album comes out. And but the biggest thing was the price, right? That's what you're really asking about here. In England, they got it down to three for the price of one. And a lot of that is because punk rock, one of the tenets of punk rock is that it has to be affordable, you know? Even the, you know, London Calling was sold for two for the price of one. And they wanted to push it even further by doing three for the price of one. And then in order to do that, they had to agree to not accept royalties on the first X amount of units sold. I don't have the exact number. I'm sorry. And the number that they were supposed to sell before they can even get royalties, London Calling hadn't even sold that many copies in America yet. So this is just a historically bad business decision. But these aren't businessmen, all right? They're a bunch of punks.
No, it is an incredibly punk move. And it's just one of the many ways in which Sandinista is the Clash's most political album. And going into your book, and one of the great things that you do so well in your book is you set the context for that by exploring the band's politics, especially that of Joe Strummer, the lead singer and songwriter. Could you share with us, like, briefly what Strummer's political beliefs were and how they were defined?
Sure. You know, and it's more complicated to answer than not, because he was a human like all of us whose political views did shift, you know, throughout time, but he always remained on the left and he always had a more progressive point of view. And he thought of himself as a socialist, but never really formally belonged to the Socialist Party because he didn't really believe in joining the Socialist Party, but he did believe in socialist values, you know, and for him, the socialist values were very humanistic. You know, for him, you know, he thought of it as just like, well, this is the most humanitarian, therefore, that's the one that I'm most aligned with, you know, which for a lot of, you know, political theorists or economists, that would be a problem. It's like, well, even in your great statements about why you believe in socialism, never really mention economics. You never really mention, you know, shifting social structures. You just mention, this is the most humanitarian, this will benefit the most people, therefore, that's how I'm voting. That's how I'm aligning myself. And so he was very, you know, as they say about the Clash, like they were anti-racist, anti-imperialist, anti-colonialism, and really just pro-humanitarian, pro-creative. You know, they were interested in making art and, you know, doing what was best for people. And, you know, so, and they did perform at like Rock Against Racism, which was also basically rock against Eric Clapton, because he was, you know, a key racist in British music in the 70s, while singing I Shot the Sheriff, nonetheless. But and also performing, you know, at strikes. You know, the last show Strummer played before he died was for firefighters. You know, so that's the way that he lived throughout his entire life, was on the left there. But not looking at socialism from a economic perspective, but more from a humanist perspective.
So before we go on to talk about the album, I want to kind of dive into this a little bit further, because it does explain a lot of the imagery and concepts throughout the album. In discussing the band's politics, you introduce a concept by Ernst Fischer called socialist realism. Could you tell us more about what socialist realism is and how that exactly relates to the Clash's music?
Sure. So socialist realism comes out of the Soviet Union and is art that is supposed to be realistic in a depiction of real life that is supposed to really support Marxist values and really be critical of the bourgeoisie. And Ernst Fischer goes a little bit further and says that, you know, he doesn't like the term. It's too propagandist and it's too there's too many limitations on it. So he prefers, socialist art, I believe is what he says. And this concept for him needs to be more inclusive. He's like, you know, the Russian writers and the artists are great. What about the Bible? What about Shakespeare? What about the Aztecs? What about Brecht? You know, what about all of these other things, right? It should be more, right, than just these kind of Soviet concepts. And of course, he's also referred to as being a heretical Marxist, for these values. But when you look at things like that, it's very easy to apply. And he's talking mostly about, you know, art in terms of painting, right? And maybe classical music, but not punk rock because it predates it by decades. But it's very easy to assign that to the Clash, who are saying, well, you know, why stick to just punk rock, or why stick to just rock music? Why couldn't we do a gospel song? Why couldn't we do calypso music? Why can't we do pop? You know, how can we reach the most amount of people as possible?
You write in your book that the Clash's most explicit attempt to align themselves with socialism is through the title of this album, Sandinista. And knowing that the record would be sold all over the world by way of this capitalist industry and, you know, how goods and services get dispersed, they wanted to promote certain ideals through that. Can you kind of bring us up to speed about how they came to specifically choose that title for that album at that time? And what the message was meant to communicate through selling through this capitalist system.
Yeah, and Joe had always defended that decision to go to a major label because he would say things like, my record is going to be sold all around the world. Anyone could buy this record. And it's so nice when you read things like Jeff Tweedy from Wealth, his memoirs, like, I got London Calling in a Kmart, you know, and it changed his life. You know what I mean? And there's value in that. You know, it doesn't just have to be like, you heard it from someone who was cooler than you, or he got at the record store. Jeff Tweedy got in at Kmart and had to kind of trick his mom into buying it for him. You know, that's important for people, you know, for kids especially. Even suburban kids who probably need to have their worldviews opened up more than anybody else, you know? So for them, you know, Joe's just saying, I like the word, you know, and not just because it does sound good. But he loves Spanish. He sings in Spanish on almost all Clash albums. But for him, it was just it had a message of hope. You know, there's a hope to it. These young rebels had just taken down the Somoza dynasty that had been in power for decades. They overthrew it, and through a revolution, which was violent, by the way, overthrew them and put in place a new form of government that focused on literacy. And had done more for women's rights in the previous, you know, and so that was very inspiring. That was just saying, hey, things can really change in the 80s. It was like, you know, let's paint a picture of what the 1980s really could look like if people grabbed onto this idea that change is possible.
I really appreciate you going into that, because I wanted to ask those questions because they really drive the musical direction of the album, and why there's so many songs and why there's such a musical variety. And there's a quote from your book I found really fascinating, and I want to quote it directly, in which you say, "The diversity of genres on Sandinista merges the musical traditions of a multitude of nations to create a transnational opus that is held together by the album's humanist and progressive themes." And I couldn't find... there's no better way to describe that album for me than that specifically right there. I think you do a brilliant job at succinctly describing it. And I just wondered if you could just expand upon that more. us.
Sure. I mean, there's a whole book that Bloomsbury put out with multiple writers about the kind of the transnational perspectives on the Clash. And that the title's good, but that what I said wasn't. But the title's good, I promise. That Bloomsbury also put out. But yeah, I mean, the transnational aspect of the Clash, I think, is what has given them such longevity in a number of ways, you know. And the whole point of it, you know, and it could be kind of slippery and maybe kind of sweaty, some of these comparisons, but you look in cases like Up in Heaven, Not Only Here, the one that Mick Jones sings, which I think is one of the best songs on the album and in the Clash catalog, where at the end of the song, they borrow Phil Oakes' lyrics, and they seem to talk about how Alianza Dollars has been on towering buildings, which is a reference to building up structures in banana republics, which, you know, teaches one, that lyric teaches who Phil Oakes is, this folk singer. So it points us there, but it also points us to Central America, at the banana republics and the issues there, and the, you know, the exploited laborers there. And then it also, right, points us inward, right, back at ourselves. So because Mick is taking this, and what that means to him is these new brutalist architecture that he's surrounded to, the tower blocks in London, these post-war towering apartment buildings, these lifeless buildings. And so, you know, now people might not like the connection of saying, like, oh, because he's not saying what's happening in banana republics is the same as what's happening in post-war England. He's not doing that. He's not, but he is, you know, he and Strummer, you know, are saying, you know, we're together, you know, that this, that it's a different struggle, but we're not that different. And we actually need to emphasize that, right? Looking at class struggle, even though, you know, they are from a different place, they speak a different language, and they are in different contexts entirely, right? But there is something unifying about trying to tie those together musically by borrowing the lyrics and combining things about the Banana Republic and comparing it to post-war Britain, right? Even though they are not the same, they are not the same struggle, but to make the attempt to unify these people, I think, is powerful, you know, to align yourself with people in the West Indies and the American South, in Eastern Europe, you know, the Afghan rebels, those in Tibet who've been displaced, you know, like, you know, they're trying to make these connections to say that, you know, really, I think, to inspire some form of unity. Like, this is not just happening out there. If it's happening out there, it's the old civil rights kind of thing, you know, and justice anywhere is everybody's concern, you know. And I think that's really what that stuff gets down to. Now, the message might be a little slippery, but it's art, and art is not as, you know, it's poetic. It's not supposed to be, you know, said perfectly.
Well, the humanist themes that kind of go through their politics and their music and through Sandinista is not just them, you know, full of hot air, because they didn't just incorporate these messages and these influences into their music. While the band are the sole writers and producers of the album, Sandinista is their most collaborative album. They brought in a whole lot of people to do this. And I don't want to say gives it authenticity, because I think that's kind of a tricky word when we're talking about music. But there's a lot of voices here from different backgrounds that are all coming together to kind of unite under this shared vision. And you could just kind of tell us about who they worked with during the recording of this album to bring that vision about.
Sure. I mean, number one, you have to talk about Mikey Dread, who probably should have been credited as a producer and got more. And he has said, you know, that was not because the Clash didn't want to credit me. That's because of CBS. I have no problems with the Clash, right? They did right by me. And you can hear him on multiple tracks here. You can hear him on Bank Robber. They would bring him out on tours to come out and, you know, grab the mic. And you can find some live footage where people kind of turned his mic down. I don't think they were understanding what the Clash were trying to do. So he was a major influence, and he is one of these kind of pioneers in dub music. So a lot of the, especially all the dub and the reggae tracks, he's a major influence. And there are some songs where he's the only really person on the vocals for, you know, an entire track, by the time you get to like side six. You know, but Injury of the Blockheads is another major influence. The Magnificent Seven bassline. Paul was out making a movie. The Fabulous Stains with the young Laura Dern. You know, so he, you know, he's not actually even playing the bass on that track. So that's important. Ellen Foley, Mick's girlfriend at the time, who sings on Bat Outta Hell, the Meatloaf album, you know, Paradise by the Dashboard Light. She sings all over this record. And she had a solo album come out that Mick and Joe wrote half the songs for, and the band recorded all the music, you know, and they did this under the confines of a spliff bunker, which they learned working with Guy Stevens can be very handy. If you use a bunch of like suitcases and flight cases, you can create some sort of bunker where everyone can smoke, drink, chill, write, and then whatever idea they come out with there, they can go into the studio, right, and lay it down, you know. So it's this huge community of people making the most of the studio space, but also trying to control it just enough to where people are pouring wine in the mixing board or on pianos like they had experienced before.
So we touched upon it briefly at the beginning of our conversation, but I want to return to it because your book approaches the songs on Santanista in a really compelling way. You write that because Santanista is so frequently referred to as this imperfect masterpiece that needs to be shortened, you explore the idea with an abridged version called Santanista Now. Can you give us some background on Santanista Now and how that informed your approach in writing the book?
Sure. So Santanista Now was not something that The Clash put together. This is something that the label put together and sent to DJs as an attempt to promote the album. And they even sent it to some critics, I think, too, because in Robert Christgau's original review, he mentioned Santanista Now, actually. So people had a copy of this. Not a lot, but it was a 12-track version of the album that was meant to have kind of like the best sampling of Santanista, you know, as a kind of a way to condense the album to kind of its essential parts. And for me, it's just like, well, if you're someone who says it should only be 12 tracks, let's look at what was by some people decided to be the most essential 12 tracks. But, you know, and with that even came like a piece of paper that said, these are the best songs. These are the ones that should be played. And they had some really bad puns calling them classics. But nevertheless, that was its intention, you know. And the it opens with Police on My Back, which is strange, you know, but especially when you have Magnificent Seven right there. But instead of having something like Washington Bullets on side five, it's on side one. So there's some pros, you could say, to the single LP that you know can't be denied. And even someone who loves the triple LP, you have to explore that. You know, so that's why. And I should also say that it could have been a really cool move of them after the success of London Calling to have this kind of white album. And I mean that because it literally was just like a white cover with like a stamp. This is The Clash, Santanista Now. That could have been a cool move from a punk perspective, you know, but that's not what they did.
So let's go ahead and start diving into the songs on the album. There's 36 of them on the entire album, but we don't have time to talk about all of them. But yeah. I do want to talk about some from Santanista Now and some from the broader album. So the proper album opens with the track Magnificent Seven, as you mentioned, but Santanista Now opens up with the cover of Police on My Back because it's more in the typical Clash style. And they stayed rather true to the original version. Can you tell us about this recording?
Yeah, it rules. You know, and I somehow keep coming back to 1977, that single, or the first White Riot single, rather, where they kind of try to create kind of the sirens, like, with their guitars. And they do it again here, but to much greater effect, because now we have just a better group of musicians. And it's a Mick song, really, you know, Mick's the one who's singing it, and they had just had a pretty good hit, America, with Train in Vain, which Mick leads. So it would make sense to try to open with a mix song because it's the most similar to a pretty big hit that they just had. And the cover is from a band called The Equals, who were an integrated rock group in Britain, and the head of which was Eddie Grant, who was known for Electric Avenue. But it's a great, huge pop song that is produced, you know, so clearly to mix Fascinations in particular. It has this almost wall of sound quality that you hear on things like The Card Cheat on London Calling. You can see that that's going to be, that sound is going to be something, that Phil Spector kind of sound is something that Mick is particularly interested and it's going to explore as a producer on this album throughout. So it's a good way to start it. Because it does ease you into some pretty wild stuff.
Yeah, it's a great song. It's really subversive in some ways, because especially when we think about the transnational aspect of Santanista, that this is being a more straightforward, like, quote-unquote Clash song, but it's coming from, like, this, you know, this different culture, this different background, and channels that way. It is the easy entryway into this broader world that they're going to be building from that.
It's also kind of like I Fought the Law. You know, it's pretty similar in that vein as well, which was also a pretty big hit for them in a way. It was on the American release of the self-titled album, which was released in 79. So that kind of attitude, you know, is something that people were clearly responding to in America from them.
So your book also delves into the mythology surrounding the Clash, such as something we were talking about earlier, this idea that punks believing signing to a major label would be the end of their movement. And one of the songs explores that concept a bit, Hitsville, UK. Could you tell us more about that?
Yeah. So, I mean, talk about, you know, Mick's producing aspirations. Hitsville, UK is, I mean, clearly a nod to Motown, you know, Hitsville, USA. And mostly features, you know, he is the lead singer in here, but Ellen Foley is kind of, you know, singing circles around him. She's kind of actually leading the song. But for me, the song seems like it has some sort of buyer's remorse, you know, buying into signing to a major label, because now you have this burgeoning, you know, do-it-yourself culture that's happening in the 70s, you know, with the mic and boom in your living room, you know, so they're shouting out, you know, by name, all these independent labels who are going to really determine what British rock music in the 80s is going to be. And I think that there's something, you know, tying Mick growing up listening to Motown records and doing some sort of pastiche for that, they're not quite nailing it, let's be honest, because Mick's not, you know, Diana Ross. You know, but tying it to this burgeoning thing of that's happening in the UK, this exciting, independent music scene. And we're 45s are all the rave. That's the thing about Motown, too. It's all about 45s. And that was happening with these, you know, punk rock, new wave, no wave, noise rock kind of scenes that were happening in Britain that they were just turning out these 45s that were creating these kind of revolutionary moment in music, where like a 45 could really change an entire music scene and what was going to happen in music for like an entire year or an entire decade.
So we kind of touched upon it a little bit, we mentioned a few times, but Magnificent Seven, it's a song that opens up the proper album. And it expresses the band's admiration for this blossoming hip-hop scene in New York. And you write that they did not want to make a novelty song because this was beginning to be a big trend, and there's a lot of artists that kind of attached raps to their music, famously Blondie and Rapture. You mentioned David Byrne's rap in Cross-Eyed and Painless from Remain in Light. And so I don't want to ask about the rap itself or the trend element, but I wanted to ask you about how the Clash supported the hip-hop scene as they were kind of discovering for themselves amidst while all these artists were like, there's something here to be tapped into that we can, you know, the correct words appropriate. So I wanted to get a sense of how the Clash kind of gave back to that scene as well.
Yeah, it was a mutual love. And it was the same thing when they were in England with the reggae. You know, if you went to a punk rock show, you would expect to hear reggae in between sets, you know, They hung out with each other, you know, the Rastas and the punks in a lot of these scenes. Now, that doesn't mean that there weren't also Nazi skinheads within the punk scene. You know, that happened too. But in America, you know, there was great admiration because these are musicians. And the punk was a new thing that was happening. And in America, hip-hop was the new thing. This post-funk, post-disco, incredibly creative way of using samples and using rhythms and creating new rhymes that were a stream of conscious that didn't rely on sloganeering or hooks, but this, you know, could just have this incredible flow. That was very, you know, revolutionary and exciting to them, you know? And they, well, Mick especially loved it. You know, he walked around with his boombox the entire time he was in New York. And, you know, when they mixed Magnificent Seven, they created the Magnificent Dance that played on New York radio stations that people were, you know, breakdancing to in the streets. It was a popular song in New York radio, you know, for people who were hip-hop enthusiasts. And for The Clash, you know, when they toured America, sometimes they would bring Bo Diddley with them or Joe Ely. And when they were in New York, they brought out, you know, Grandmaster Flash, Fab Five Freddy, you know, the Sugar Hill Gang. You know, they wanted to make sure that people knew what the new exciting thing was. And that wasn't always well received. Some Clash fans were not ready to accept hip hop like the Clash were. Sometimes they would get booed, and there's a documentary about Joe Strummer where Steve Buscemi, of all people, says that he was at one of these shows, and when they were booing, the hip hop openers, Joe would come out and say, "Hey, you need to listen. You know, you need to really listen to what's happening here because this is something really exciting and we love it. So you need to open your minds." You know, just like really, really kind of, you know, reprimanding them for not, you know, being accepting and not being open to, you know, what was happening. And they know no one's going to live with this more than Mick. When he does, you know, Big Audio Dynamite.
I really like that emphasis on opening your mind, and it kind of segues to the next song I want to talk about, Washington Bullets, which you call the most essential song on the album because it encapsulates who the Clash are and what they stand for. You made a comment earlier on about how some of these songs became like a person's introduction to certain concepts or certain people, and Washington Bullets has a lot of political influences on it. Victor Jara, for example, some of these were the first time I'd ever heard some of these names or ideas. So I just want to, I want to hear from, I know why I feel this way, but I want to hear from you about why you consider Washington Bullets to be the album's most essential song on the album.
Most obviously is that it's the closest thing we have to a title track. You know, the Alan Foley and others, you know, sing Sandinista as some sort of chorus, some sort of chant, some big hurrah, you know, so that's the obvious thing. But it just, to my ears, it's something that's very exciting and very, it has all of the ethos that they've always had, and now it's kind of maybe reaching like its fullest potential here, you know, because the whole thing moves and has the drive of a punk song, but it also has a marimba. And that's Topper playing the marimba, you know, which can, you know, when people talk about Topper in this time, they focus on his drug problems, which were present and, you know, terrible. But wow, does he show up on this album doing some amazing stuff. I mean, just the opening drum fill alone is just incredibly exciting to me. It's not like Tommy Gunn, which has like that machine gun quality to it. This is something different, but for me, even more exciting than Tommy Gunn. But yeah, I think, you know, this is Joe's Jeremiad. You know, this is kind of, you know, what this is finally him doing what everyone's kind of accused him of doing, you know, and now he's really owning it and doing the absolute best version of it by talking about Allende and Victor Jara and the Sandinistas. And I think that if someone were to ask me, like, who is Joe Strummer? Why was he important? Why do people care about him? Why do they say, oh, The Clash changed my life, Joe Strummer changed my life, I think you could show them Washington Bullets and be like, this is it. This kind of checks off all the boxes. And even though it's not a traditional punk rock song, you know, the fact that they are attempting this at all is a great act of punk in my mind.
So those are just some of the songs on the Sandinista Now, which only scratch the surface of the album. So I want to kind of shift gears and talk about some of the tracks that are on the proper album. And some of them are really musically peculiar for The Clash. I'm not talking about hip hop or the reggae or the dub. I'm thinking about tracks like Something About England and Rebel Waltz. Can you talk about how those songs they sound so atypical from what we expect from The Clash?
First of all, you know, having Something About England as the side one closer and then Rebel Waltz as the side two opener, that's a lot for people to try to grab onto when you're hearing a new Clash album, because they are so entirely different from the rest of the catalog. But Something About England, it's funny because so many people criticize this album for being too American. And I think a lot of that's because of Magnificent Seven opening the record and then Hitsville UK coming after with the Motown thing. But then Something About England is incredibly British. You know, it's like a British music hall number that is really kind of Dickensian, you know, in nature. You know, and it's something that actually breaks from social realism and starts to become a little bit more surreal. And Rebel Waltz is the same thing, where we're so used to the social realist kind of Washington Bullets. Here's an issue that's literally happening, or has literally happened. And this is more poetic. And it's something that I don't think Joe or the band would do if it weren't a 36-track album. You know, if it's just like, hey, we need 12 of the best songs. And that doesn't give you a lot of room to do a punk rock song that's a waltz. I mean, it's in 3/4 time. You know, I don't know if there are how many more punk songs at all, or how many other punk bands have done something in 3/4 like this, with a really weird opening, the dream quality of the lyrics, the dream quality of the production. It's a moment that, as I said before, it dips from the realism and into a surrealism that is still deeply rooted in the humanist kind of themes that the band is always pushing. You know, but you know, I don't say this in the book, but it is something more like watching something, you know, like if you want to talk about Soviet cinema, kind of like watching The Cranes Are Flying, or like watching Soy Cuba, where it is interested in realism, but it has this poetic slant to it that makes it something more dreamy and effective, you know, for some people, for me.
So at the end of your book, you spotlight several guest contributors who each compile their own version of Sandinista Now. I don't know what my selections would be. I would find it very hard to distill it down to a Sandinista Now. My kind of thing has been, I've been listening to the album on shuffle with all the songs in a different order, which has been, you know, brings out different things for me. But if I were to try to narrow things down, I know Corner Soul would be very high on that list. And when I was looking through the other people's list, I was very disappointed that only two other people have put Corner Soul on that list. And I think it's great. And I think it's a song that with themes that are still sadly very relevant today. Mm-hmm. Could you tell us more about that song and the significance of its meaning?
Yeah, sure. So in the book, I approached this song probably because the Get Back documentary come out not too long ago, especially when I was writing this. It was so fun to see Paul, you know, riffing on the song that would become Get Back and saying things like, you know, don't dig no Pakistanis, because he's Get Back is starting as a protest song against Enoch Powell, who gave this anti-immigration speech in 1968 that's called the River of Blood speech. You know, so the refrain in the song is, you know, is this music calling for a river of blood, talking about black music, which is reggae music in England. And, you know, this is, you know, reggae music Even Bob Marley has lyrics and songs about wanting to blow up a church. I shot the sheriff. The style's funny. It's the way that hip hop was talked about in the 80s. You know, gangster rap music. It's just like, these people are calling for violence. They want to kill police officers. They want to, you know, so it shouldn't be a sentiment that is so strange to us here in the 21st century, or people who grew up in the 90s or late 80s, you know, the people having concern for black music and using their concern for black music to really just discriminate against black people. And I think that's what Joe's really concerned about in this song, which is one of my favorites. I hope I put it, based on your sentiments, I hope I put it on my list. I think I know I had it on some versions of my list. It did. Okay. It is on my file. Good. So I did have Corner Soul, so I'm glad I could be in your good graces there. And so did Aaron Cohen. Thank goodness.
So Cinema inspired The Clash a lot, and even Strummer kind of dabbled with filmmaking himself for Hell West 10, which, if you've not seen, find a copy of the Essential Clash DVD. It's there. It's worth a watch. I hadn't seen it in a long time. I need to revisit it. But, you know, he kind of has this eye for cinema in his songwriting. And you can see, you can hear a lot of the cinematic qualities throughout their music, but especially so on Sandinista. Can you talk about Charlie Don't Surf and how that track satirizes American imperialism through popular culture?
I would like to talk about Charlie Don't Surf, and I would like to talk about movies for another hour, because it's so important to The Clash at this point. These are people who are really interested in these auteur new Hollywood filmmakers, especially Scorsese, which, again, mutual love, right? You can see pictures of Scorsese on the set of Raging Bull wearing a Clash shirt. He puts them as extras in a comedy around the time of this album. And he has some good stories about being with them in that Joe Strummer documentary that I talked about. But I think that they thought with Sandinista they were making something like Apocalypse Now. I mean, which Sandinista Now probably would have been a great title for the LP and an even worse title for the 12-track, you know, promo. You know, because Sandinista Now implies Apocalypse Now, implies a big epic and, you know, maybe irresponsibly big, even like Apocalypse Now, in terms of like how many shooting days and how many, you know, miles of film they shot. But, you know, and in a lot of ways, you know, you could look at Sandinista as kind of their Heaven's Gate moment, their Michael Cimino moment, where they're trying to do something that's so big that people are gonna be like, okay, that's too big. We gotta reel it in. We gotta find a ceiling, right? To keep these crazy artists under control. Which comes out the same year as Heaven's Gate and Raging Bull and Dressed to Kill and all these people who are, you know, part of the new Hollywood kind of coming into this big moment in 1980. But Charlie Don't Surf, in particular, is a direct reference to Apocalypse Now, and it even starts with, you know, these kind of helicopter sounds that sound like the revolutionary, you know, soundscape and sound effects in Apocalypse Now. But then it becomes this kind of surf number, which you might expect the reggae, you might expect the dub, and the rockabilly and the gospel. Gospel's just like rock music, you know. That's not a stretch. But surf, Beach Boys, what are we doing? That's the Ramones thing. The Clash don't do that, but they do with Charlie Don't Surf because they have something to say there. Actually, you know, when they explore genres, do we have something to say in this genre? And with Charlie Don't Surf, using this kind of surf, I think they definitely do. You know, satirizing again American imperialism, and doing it in a way that is a nod to a genre that they are encouraged through, you know, very bold filmmaking that is still at the heart of it, fueled by this humanist perspective, this anti-Vietnam, which I think really sets off a new trend, because combat rock in 82 after this is very obsessed with Vietnam. Especially with the song Straight to Hell. So this is kind of, you know, lyrically and thematically setting them up for like the next thing as well, which is weird that this is not on Sandinista Now, but the little like sheet that came with Sandinista Now does mention that this is one of the best songs on the album. But they leave it off, which is interesting.
The last two tracks I want to ask you about are kind of strange, but I think they're so underrated, and I kind of think of them as a little bit musically connected. Kingston Advice and The Street Parade. What are your thoughts on those tracks? Because I really think they're, you know, they kind of reveal a kind of experimentation that is not as obvious as a lot of the other songs, especially some of the dub songs, but I find them so thrilling to listen to.
Kingston Advice, I think, is a song that's kind of unfairly put too far back on the album. I think if it were earlier in the record, people would probably have more fun with it. And I think sonically also sounds something more akin to combat rock, but I think it says a lot more about where the Clash is going musically. But it's a song that I really like too. I think that people, I really just think it's a matter of it being buried in the track list. People kind of sleep on it because people get really afraid of, you know, side five and especially side six. So I just think that, you know, it'll get slept on. But A Street Parade, right, you want to talk about Street Parade? I think that, I mean, that's one of my favorite Clash songs, period. And it's so interesting to me, just the big musical moment. You know, it's a slow start, and when the music kicks in, you have this guitar that has this delay effect that is not matching with the drums at all. But Tabrahim, being a good drummer, is going to power through, and he's going to make sure that we're staying in time, and he's going to guide us through this cacophony. And Strummer, over top of it, has this kind of really kind of like, you know, I will never fade, you know, kind of heroic kind of moment here. That inspires you to find meaning in the sound and the cacophony and to push them out of it. And in the end, you're grooving. You know what I mean? And I think that's kind of the importance of the music, is to in chaos, you know, and in this cacophony sound is finding the beauty in it and then getting out on the other side with other people, you know. And I think that if this were a 12-track album, I think it would be like a perfect kind of closing track. And in some ways, it is kind of a closing track. In a way, there are like four closing tracks on this album. But to me, it's a great song. And it clearly means something to them, because by the time they did Clash on Broadway, you know, that CD set and that cassette, you know, box set, it was a hidden track. So there's something about that song that they could resist leaving. I mean, that's a compilation that they put together themselves, you know. So that was something that clearly meant something to them as well. But it's one for me that was hard to write about and still hard to talk about because, I react to it so emotionally and so deeply, more than I do intellectually.
How did the band feel about the album when it was released?
Sure. Well, when it was released, I think they were confident in it, you know, and they're definitely, you know, mixed feelings. I think some people in the band thought that it could have been smaller. It would have been really nice to be a fly on the wall when they all had to decide to not get the royalties on those copies, you know, that were sold. But they had confidence that when they do those shows at Bonds Casino, they're playing a good amount of these songs. You know, I think they were discouraged when the singles didn't do well. They probably knew, we're not making our money back on this one. But I they're pretty hard-headed, these guys. You know, I know Joe, over time, his thoughts about it changed. He says, you know, I've gone back and forth on this, but, you know, in one of his later interviews said, but the more I think about it, there's some good stuff on there, there's some horrible stuff on there, and I'm proud of all of it. You know, but Topper, you know, in contemporary interviews will say, like, it could have been shorter. We did eat all that, you know. But at the time, I think they had a great time making it, because they were in charge. You know, and they all took writing credits. They were producing it. They did not have their manager, Bernie Rhodes. You know, so it was the most free they were ever going to be. It was the most freedom they were ever given to make a record. And that's what they did. They put it all out there. I mean, very literally, everything that they had. Well, not everything. I mean, if you can believe it or not, there are a couple of tracks that are not on this record that they recorded around the time, but very few didn't make it. Very few things didn't make it. So, you know, I think for them, it was just one of the most, and they loved being in New York. They loved being in New York. So I think for them, they loved the experience, and they were proud of the album, even if they probably have differing ideas about how long it should have been.
For my last couple of questions, I want to ask you about the album's legacy. You described Sandinista as a guide and a tool. How did you come to view the album that way?
Sure. You know, one, for some of the things we've already talked about, you know, it's there's so much to learn without any of it being preachy, and nothing really feels like he's sermonizing or like they're sermonizing, and nothing feels like a lecture, which sometimes even like really, you know, intellectual hip hop can be like, you know, there's a, you know, an SNL joke there where I think Sterling K. Brown is playing Common on Celebrity Jeopardy, and, you know, Kanan as Steve Harvey's like, man, it's like being at church and school at the same time, you know, it never feels that way. But there are so many things that you can learn about British politics that don't feel distant to us, you know, and as I was in American politics that do not feel distant to us, and global politics that do not feel distant to us at all. You know, this is something that, because it's so concerned with humanity, you know, it's always going to be relevant, you know, and when I was thinking about this album deeply, it was 2020 is when I was really listening to this album constantly, you know, and there were so many things happening. You know, my wife and I would drive to protests listening to Sandinista, you know, so for us, quite literally, it was a little bit of a tool. You know, it was, you know, those anthemic songs for us really meant something to us. And they didn't feel distant, even though they were not about what we were doing, where we were going, or anything. It never felt far removed. And so they were very deeply meaningful in that time. And I think it's just going to be true for any kind of like sociopolitical context.
So for my final question, and you kind of touched upon this a little bit, but I want to dig into it a little bit more. You write in your book that the excess of the album strengthens its longevity by offering more to revisit and discover over time. So you mentioned that you listened to the album a lot over 2020, and that was viewed within the context of what was happening with COVID and George Floyd and eventually the election. So I wanted to kind of just hear your words.
Well, I also want to mention Breonna Taylor, because so that was, you know, especially for us, I'm in Lexington, and then she was in Louisville. So that case in particular was very important. So sorry to interrupt you, but I did want to mention.
No, it was incredibly important. There was a lot happening at that time, and you know, with that kind of local connection, certainly I certainly certain passions are inflamed for that, and rightfully so. So I want to know, what did you discover while writing the book that you did not realize before, whether about the album or about yourself?
Sure. Well, you have an idea when you put a book proposal together. You're like, okay, I know I'm going to write about all 36 songs, and for most of these, they're about specific things, so I know. But then you get to side six, and you're like, I don't know what I'm going to do. you put off writing that chapter for a long time. You're like, there's a song that's just another song backwards. What can I write about that? You know, and so that's a challenge, and that's a writing challenge. That's a creative challenge. You know, how do I say something interesting or thought provoking about a song that is, to me, on an album that I love, is clearly filler and not really interesting, and you spend time with it, and you listen to the song backwards over and over again, and you're just like, okay, now I'm getting more nutty. But then something clicks, and you're like, well, which song is it playing backwards? Oh, it's playing Something About England. And Something About England tracks, you know, it's this that Dickensian thing of someone telling, you know, an older man telling a younger man about everything that England had gone through and all these during wartime. What does it mean that that song is played in reverse? And then I think about war in reverse. And then, of course, I'm a young man who read Vonnegut in high school, like so many of us. And you think about the images in Slaughterhouse-Five of Billy Pilgrim watching this bombing, and then he's unstuck in time, so he watches it in reverse. And so he watches, you know, the sky swallow up these flames and these planes, you know, sucking up all of the shrapnel and all this kind of stuff, and they're taking them to distant places so the scientist can put these, you know, weapons, tear them apart, and then put these resources, bury them deep in the ground so no one can use them for harm. You know, you're like, well, no, that's great. And that, and his, you know, I don't know, I don't have any reference of them reading Vonnegut, but of course he's one of the great anti-war writers we've ever had in America. And so then you think about that song, and all of a sudden now, that song, having meditated on it for so long and then written about it, means not as much to me as Slaughterhouse-Five, but now they're connected. I've tied these two things together to where when I listen to this song that's just gobbledygook, you know, in reverse for some people, to me has incredible meaning tied to this novel that has this great anti-war message, even though there's really no words. And the song to me now has an incredible depth that I don't get out of something like Revolution Number 9, for example.
Well, Micaiah, thank you so much for speaking with me today. This was quite a feat to tackle such a grandiose album, but you did an absolutely amazing job, and I think you should be very proud. And congratulations on the publishing of your book.
Thank you so much.
My name is Bradley Morgan, and you've been listening to New Books and Music with my guest today, Micaiah Henley. His latest book is The Clash's Sandinista, and it's published by Bloomsbury Academic.